So, this afternoon, I wanted to talk a little bit about the beauty of the dying process, the potential of the dying process for our freedom and awakening, and how to support somebody potentially through that process. Because many of us, probably the older we get, start to hear about loved ones getting sick, getting terminal diagnoses, or just starting to disappear, starting to get dementia and not be able to kind of relate to us in the way they used to be able to. And the older we get, the more this starts happening to peers. I had my treasurer staying with me recently until yesterday, I think, and she made the point that in the beginning, it's people who are older than you that you hear about dying. And then it starts to be kind of people not that much older. And after a while, it starts to be your sisters, your friends. Yeah, for some of us, maybe even our children, which is, one of the biggest tragedies I think a parent can ever go through. But nevertheless, however old we are, we will be hearing about people passing away. There are also people in this room that I know of who are palliative nurses, or that work with people close to their death and see a lot of sickness and suffering and death around them. And sometimes this is very heavy because we're faced with it so much, it might be hard to kind of stay resourced and stay positive and really know how to cope. So I wanted to talk a bit about that and just to see if we can start to work with our own fears of death in a way that enables us to stay more present for others. So I think this is the first thing really that I want to share is the importance of doing our own work. Recognizing that our own bodies are impermanent and facing some of the fears around that gently, but persistently in a sense, so that we are able, when the time comes, to hold the space for others without unnecessarily burdening our loved ones with our own fears of them leaving us. Because often what we're more afraid of is not the other person going through the suffering. I mean, sometimes, of course, we care very much. We don't want to see someone we love suffer. But often it's also our own fears of what we'll do without them. And a very obvious example comes to mind of a good friend of mine in Perth who was in great health until probably last June or July, so she thought. And she'd had a COVID infection and thought that she was still suffering some weakness from that. So she went to the doctors and they said, "I'm afraid it's more than that." And she said, "Well, what do you mean?" And they said, "You've actually got a very rare and aggressive form of bowel cancer, stage 4." And this person was 70 years old, so you might say not particularly young, but in the middle of her life, working on moving back to Thailand, where her husband was from Perth, and they had plans. They had plans for the future. And her husband was absolutely devastated, even though he's from a Buddhist culture. He hadn't done the death contemplation. He hadn't really ever envisaged that could happen to his wife. And I think she was the main kind of provider. She was the one bringing in, the support for them both in Perth because he didn't speak great English. She'd spent a lot of time out in Thailand. And I went to see her several times in the hospice where she stayed in the last months of her life. And it was remarkable just to see how she was starting to let go. And even though family members would come and visit, even some cousins from the UK, I kind of felt like I was in the way because I knocked on the door and she had her cousins there that had flown all that way. And I said, "Oh, do you want some more space?" No, please come in." And when they left, she said, "They were talking about the past and what we used to do together and remember this time, remember that time." She said, "Fine, they're lovely people, but I just want to talk about death. I haven't got time for that," she said. "I just haven't got time." And that was how the conversation with me began, because I was thinking, well, what have I got to say to her? What sort of wisdom do I think I can share? But there was no need, because all she wanted to do was to process her own experience with someone who could hold the space. And that was really beautiful and a great privilege for me, because she was sharing the details. Being a psychotherapist and a meditator for about 40 years, she was able to articulate the details of what was happening in her body and mind in such depth. It was really eye-opening and a great privilege for me. And she was so excited about the whole thing, very, very present. People had brought a Buddha Rupa, a Buddha statue, to her room, about this size actually, and flowers. And the whole room felt like a kind of mini retreat. It felt like her own private meditation cell, if you like, full of goodness, full of good energy. And she told me, kind of with some regret, I think, but in quite an objective way, that her husband just couldn't come because he was far too devastated. He just could barely look after himself. He could barely get washed or dressed. So there was no way he could bear to see her there and to see that she was in the last stages of her life. So I think she had to let that go. You know, the one dying also has to let go, right? And just focus on her own process. And it was very interesting to hear her talk about how at certain times while she was meditating, or even, you know, just in a state of sort of semi-consciousness, she would have this sense of something that lay beyond the body and the five sense world. She said her meditation wasn't particularly deep, which everybody thinks, actually. Everybody always thinks that, even if they've been meditating 40 years or whatever, unless they're really prone to, you know, what's the word, overestimation or spiritual narcissism. But most people think, oh, you know, I can barely watch the breath. Is my meditation up to it? But at the times like this, it really comes to the fore. And she started getting this sense. She said it was like she saw in her mind what she called a room of delights. And she would kind of go into there and she would sense that it was full of love and full of joy and peace. And she was drawn to it, but couldn't quite let herself fully enter. She couldn't quite leave the realm of the body and the senses, but it was feeling more and more real than the body world was anymore. And the other thing she said that was notable was that, I mean, it was a lovely place. It was a hospice on top of a hill, lots of forest and a very peaceful atmosphere. But I think in these places, it's really the people who work there, especially in palliative care, that are just like devas. In Buddhism, we have something called like a celestial being. And I don't know, I've been in hospitals in Burma when I was really sick and had all this stuff through my nose. And anyway, they do strange things to you, put all this stuff in and needles and... And the nurses were just like angels, you know, they'd come over in the night and I just feel so incredibly pleased to see them. And it was almost worth being in there just to be surrounded by so much care. And for her too, she said whenever somebody came through the door, whether it be a nurse or a visitor, she'd just feel incredible love and gratitude. And she said, I don't know why I'm feeling it. I'm not trying. And I said, it's the last 40 years of your life. This is what you've been practicing all this time. So really take confidence in that, because there's these myths in Buddhist circles, unfortunately, that come mainly from the Abhidhamma, from the commentaries, that would hold that the last mind moment or the last thought that you have determines your next life, determines the future life. And it doesn't say anything like this in the suttas. The Buddha never said this. He actually implied that it's the general inclination of your mind throughout your life that determines a favorable or unfavorable rebirth. You don't have to believe in rebirth to take this on. You know, you can just think of that moment that you're facing the end of your life and what kind of qualities that you'd like to arouse. You know, would you like to be feeling all the kind of resentments and all the things you wished you'd done that you should have done better? Or would you like to be feeling this sense of genuine gratitude and love and almost looking forward? The other thing my friend said at one point, after talking to me for a couple of hours, she said, it'd almost be disappointing now if I don't die, wouldn't it? Because she was really starting to look forward, right? Can you imagine? So it's not only kind of becoming sober about it and starting to make peace with it. We can actually start to look forward to the dying moments as a kind of culmination of a life well lived. And of course, it can also be a real opportunity for spiritual growth, because if we have been training in letting go, if we have been preparing for this, you know, in our practice, in our meditation, in the way we live our lives, then this is the ultimate letting go. Here we're letting go of our possessions, which is a lot easier than letting go of our body. We're letting go of our loved ones. We're letting go of the things we identify with, our status, our intellect. You know, you can see even with great minds that they start to become kind of, they start to forget their memory after some time, forget their, you know, their knowledge. They can't remember which sutta said what, and it all gets muddled up. You know, we spend so much of our life accumulating stuff, whether it's physical stuff or intellectual stuff or, you know, self-identity stuff. And in the end, none of it really matters anymore. You know, it's just that feeling in your heart and how far that can carry you, how much you can let go. So one of the really important things, I think, when we're sitting by someone who's dying, or we hear about someone who, you know, has just been given a diagnosis that's scary, sometimes we don't know what to say, and it's okay to admit that. It's okay to say, I really don't know what to say, you know, to you right now. And just to be really honest and open and ask them how they feel. You know, give them space to process their emotions. And if we've processed ours to some extent, then we're able to hold the space for other people. You know, we're able to sit there while they cry or while they tremble or, you know, whatever it is they want to share, we're able to just provide a loving presence. And that is sometimes enough, a non-judgmental ear. So just to listen to them, to try to soothe them, to give them the gift of time, not to be in a hurry. These are their last moments, you know, so as much as we can to be present. And also to give them the confidence to die. Again, there are a lot of myths in Buddhism. Another one, other than this last mind moment thing, is the idea that someone dying has somehow, it could be a result of some kind of bad karma. Now, the Buddha never said this. He actually said that the cause of death is... anyone? Yeah. So if you want to say that's your bad karma, fair enough. We were born due to our delusion. Hopefully we were born due to some good qualities, and that's why we are in a favorable state. But basically, death has to happen, and it can happen at any time. So there is some place in the sutta where it says that a short life, or sorry, no, somebody who performs unwholesome karma may, as one of the results of that, have a short life. May have a short life. So that means that that's one possible outcome of performing bad karma. What the Buddha never said is that if you have a short life, that's the result of bad karma. Do you see the difference there? It's a possible outcome, but it isn't something you can actually trace back. Karma is what we're doing now, and it has a result in the future. We're not supposed to try to deduce what somebody did in the past based on their situation now. So this is one way that it's wrongly applied, and I think very damaging, because it can lead us, rather than having compassion for a person, to have a dismissive kind of attitude. Well, you know, maybe they did something wrong. They, I don't know, maybe they did something really bad, and that's why they're sick now, or they have a short life now. In fact, karma is one of only one of seven things, reasons for things to happen. Others are things like weather, accidents, absences of mindfulness, the balance in the body or the imbalances in the body, so physical causes. And, you know, maybe sometimes it's DNA, it's genetics, right? It can be congenital or hereditary conditions that we have. And again, the Buddha said the length of the life is nowhere near as important as the quality of the life once had. So try to remove those kind of fears and remind them that dying is not their fault. They haven't done anything wrong. This is not a punishment in any way. This is something that's inevitable. And it's an opportunity to make good karma now, you know, that can lead on to more peace in the future. It's like you're putting down one vehicle, like an old clapped out car, and you're getting a better vehicle to carry on in the future. So it can actually be an enormous relief if we're in a sick and tired body. I know for myself, I mean, I do have a chronic condition and I'm often pretty chronically tired. And it can be a real relief just to lie down and sleep. You know, it can be wonderful, and I can develop lots of feelings of metta for my body and gratitude and just allow the body to fade. Of course, this isn't the same as dying, but still, you know, imagine the peace of putting down a body that is so much in pain, that's so sick. And sometimes when I do talk to people in palliative care or Buddhist chaplains, they say there's nothing. Actually, Ajahn Brahm as well, he's seen many people pass away. And he also said that one of the saddest things you can see in life is a person struggling at death. You know, it can be so sad to see that inability to let go, that fear that can come up because we're so identified with this body as me and mine. So the more we can start to see the body as an aspect of nature that doesn't belong to anyone, doesn't belong to ourselves, and even learn to give back our body to nature. You know, we can, there's many types of meditation. I'm not going to do this one today, but we can practice in a way where we intentionally imagine ourselves giving the body back to the earth, giving the fluids in the body back to the water element, giving the heat, the temperature in the body back to the fire element, and the air, the breath back to the air, right? And eventually the whole body just crumbles into dust. And before long, I mean, there's nothing left at all. So we can practice in this way, even as a perception. And this really helps at the time of death. I've seen with my own eyes too, not a lot of dying and death, but a good friend of mine who was younger than I am now, she was 46 when she passed away, and I saw how the dying process really did catalyze her spiritual path. It was incredibly inspiring for me, although there was some sadness that she was leaving the world so soon. I fully respected her choices, which were not to take the conventional medical route. It was a kind of cancer that could have been removed, but intuitively, perhaps, she sensed that she had something else to learn from the journey. And I don't think she intended to die. I don't think she intended, she knew it was a risk, but I'm not sure how much of a risk she thought it would be. But at some point she'd done so much emotional healing. There was also a case of sexual abuse in the childhood. She'd managed to forgive this person who was actually her father. And she'd practiced meditation to quite some depth. And just found that resentments and fears and sadnesses, conflicts were getting resolved and everything was just dropping away. The problems were just dropping, dropping, dropping. There was nothing to hold. And she did come to the point where she said, my emotional journey is done. I think I'm, you know, fully at peace and maybe now I'll get better. But she knew she might not. And unfortunately, she didn't. But even right until the time, I was in contact with her till about 2 days before her death, and she was joking about what was happening to her body. She was like, oh, I'm bleeding faster than they can put the blood back in, which doesn't sound particularly lovely, right? But it was the way she said it. She was just so accepting, and she had a friend with her who was just meditating by her bed for the last few days of her life. And she was writing to me and you know, kind of asking me to send a message to Ajahn Brahm, and he was sending metta to her. We were both sending metta to her. She was kind of choosing all the quotes she wanted read out at the funeral. And honestly, I couldn't cry. I couldn't cry. I actually, it sounds really weird, and please don't take this as kind of subversive or something, but I almost felt a slight envy for the speed in which she was progressing on the path. It was like, wow, this is almost attractive, you know, to see somebody go through that process and to see how things, burdens are just dropping away. So I always felt a feeling of rejoicing with her rather than crying or grieving for her journey, because who am I to say how long she should have lived? That would have been for me and not for her. We can also remind people of their goodness. This is something very important to do, to help them get in a state of mind where they recollect the good in their lives. You know, in neuroscience, it's been shown that our minds are basically like, is it Velcro for the negative experiences and Teflon for the good? So anything negative just sticks immediately, you know, I don't know about you, but you can probably all think of plenty of things, and please don't, that you regret, you know. And they're probably the kind of things that if you tell somebody, they'll say, is that all? That's really not so bad. I did that too. I'm sure other people have done that too, right? But the good stuff, I've noticed when I try and praise people, because I try to use my speech to encourage people a lot, and it takes two or three attempts before they actually listen. First, they just go, oh, no, 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 no. And it's almost like a physical push. And then they try and say, oh, but you. But no, no, you. You did this. You are this good, this good. It's like, no, 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 I'm talking about you. Have you ever had this? And you're trying to bring up this person's quality. Even if they hear it, they say, oh, it's nothing. It's nothing. They don't say that about the bad stuff. They say, yeah, that's something. But about the good stuff, anyone would do it, you know. But it's not the case. So we can remind people. And I read a story about one man who actually kept a diary of all the things that people had done for him that were beautiful, and also of the things that he'd done for others. And as he was in the hospital approaching the end of his life, he had somebody read it to him every day so that this stuff was in his mind, you know? Don't go in and read somebody the newspaper. Don't even read the newspaper for yourself. Read your gratitude journal. It's much more uplifting than anything else. And we can say, yeah, but that's not reality. That's not real life. Isn't it all what we bring to our mind? I mean, what is real anyway? You know, we create the mind by the way we perceive, by the way, you know, we regard the world. So why don't we focus a little bit on the beauty and on the joy and the wonderful things we've contributed? You know, even the times we just tried our best, it's something to be really, I mean, not necessarily proud, but really grateful for, you know, that we've had conditions that have enabled us to practice this far. And to also remind people or remind ourselves that if we have made mistakes, we were doing the best we could at the time, yeah, with the information, with the wisdom or lack of wisdom or limited wisdom that we had at that time. You know, and if we can see something as a mistake, it means we've grown, doesn't it? If we can see that, oh, at that time I spoke a little harshly, or maybe I was judging someone without realizing it. Now that we know that, that means we've seen something we couldn't see before. So give yourself the benefit of the doubt and a bit of forgiveness. You know, we can only know what we know when we know it. We can't know it before we know it. And this is what the journey of life is all about. It's a learning journey, and it's a process of forgiveness. So it's so important to start forgiving, or at least intending to forgive, while we're still alive. Sometimes people have hurt us very gravely, very deeply, in a way that's created trauma or, you know, has been hard to bear. Even that, if we approach it wisely, if we can open our hearts with compassion, first of all to ourselves, and then to other beings. Don't worry about the perpetrator of harm. You know, that might be a step too far right now, but we can open our hearts to ourselves, to other people suffering, and we can be a source for their healing because we've been there. We've traveled that road. And then you'll find the more you can resource yourself this way, the forgiveness for the more difficult people does come along when we're ready in our own time. So we remind people of their goodness now. You know, it's so sad, isn't it, that at funerals we often read out people's eulogies and they're wonderful. They're such glowing reports of their life, and I'm sure most people would never expect to be spoken about that way, you know, or people come along to the funeral that they didn't even know cared and they have all these wonderful things to say. And it's just a shame, because why didn't they do the eulogy while they were alive? I heard of one person in Perth who actually did that. They arranged their own funeral while they were alive. Just so they could see who came, so they could decide who to give the inheritance to. Not really, but maybe. But also to hear what people had to say. And I'm sure that that is not about embellishing one's ego. That is about giving one some uplift and some encouragement, right, to continue living a good life. Today in the train, again, we were talking with this guy. He was a very mature and wonderful person, 30-year-old guy, who I thought was an excellent role model for other men. He was kind of a, what can you call that, when somebody's like a, they train them their body, so he was like a sports person, and he had a business, but his whole life was seemed to me to be more about applying the Dhamma principles to whatever he did, to bring out more benefit for others and to be a really inspiring example. And he didn't seem to have very much stress at all. You know, he had a lot of energy and a lot of brightness and joy and just wanted to talk about meditation for the entire journey from Oxford to London, which was wonderful. But he said that a lot of his friends, they're also in sort of positions like his where they're running their own businesses. He said one friend was a 30-year-old corporate lawyer, and that corporate lawyer couldn't actually go to sleep at night because he was so incredibly stressed. And he was saying just how crazy that seems, you know, that you've got this job which you should be enjoying, which should be helping others, and you've worked so hard for it, you're probably financially secure at a young age, and yet he can't sleep because of the stress. And he was also saying about some of his other business colleagues who use really harsh self-talk to kind of keep them going because they feel that's what's needed to continue kind of dealing with the pressure and, you know, being competitive in the market. And we were just saying about how, you know, any school teacher would know that talking harshly to a student and criticizing them for the work is very, very demotivating. What anybody needs is actually a lot of encouragement, a lot of support. So we need to learn to talk to ourselves like this and to talk to one another like this and to give one another that encouragement that we do have the qualities that we need, you know, to live a really beneficial life. Two more things. One is the importance, because of our clinging, because these people that we care about, we regard them as ours, we have to give them permission to die. Yeah. Sometimes people are holding on because they don't want to put us through the loss. You know, they're worried about how we'll cope without them. You know, in the case of my friend, her husband was devastated. He didn't think he could carry on to live without her. And I'm sure that weighed down on her. But luckily, because he was from Thailand, his backup plan was to go there and become a monk. And for me, I always think, well, if you're going to ordain, it's good to go there, you know, because of your love for meditation and for the Dhamma, etc. And she said, actually, in that country, a lot of people go to kind of avoid the perils of alcoholism and things like that. And I thought, well, if the monasteries are serving that purpose, maybe that's not a bad thing, you know, because according to some studies, the opposite of addiction to alcohol or drugs is actually connection in community. And of course, as monks, they get this automatic sense of respect. People respect them, support them, they have a role, they have something to live up to. And it can be a very wonderful thing. It can be a huge refuge for people like him. So we have to give people permission to die because sometimes they're holding on for us. And I think that's one of the reasons that often people die when the relatives are out of the room. You know, they feel they can have their moment and they don't have to manage the other person's emotions. So if we can let them go, it makes it a lot easier for them. And lastly, I think for ourselves and for others to try and enjoy the dying process, because the dying process, from what I can figure, especially from reading about near-death experiences, is ever so similar to the process of meditation. It's a process whereby we're gradually leaving the body, leaving our attachment to the body and moving beyond to the realm of the mind. And there are some wonderful descriptions and stories about this in a book on near-death experiences by Bruce Grayson, I think it is. He's an American doctor, and I would really recommend this book. It's a kind of novel-sized book, so it's not one of these big academic books. It's very readable, almost kind of a bit, not really novel-y, but it is a genuine scientific book, but it's written in a very easy way. And it's called After. So he doesn't call it afterlife or whatever because he doesn't want to make any comments on that. But it's after, what happens after the brain, the body turns off. And the really interesting thing here is that many people report this sense that The mind is able to expand beyond its usual constraints once the body and the brain actually are pronounced clinically dead. And people report all kinds of experiences that sound very, very much like what happens in deep meditation. I don't know how many people here might have meditated to the point where the body at least starts to fade and a feeling of peace starts to grow in the mind. The mind becomes much stronger and the qualities of the mind start to take over. Sometimes the mind seems luminous and can manifest as a sense of softness like cotton wool, or it can manifest as a light, a lot of brightness in the mind. And it's almost exactly the same process that people describe in these near-death experiences. So they are profoundly blissful a lot of the time. And almost every time, you know, that it's recorded and reported in this book, the person coming back to the body is disappointed to be back. They're actually kind of like, oh, it was so wonderful there, but okay, I'm back again. And their lives change as a result. So I wanted to read a few stories, not the exact story, but I just made a few notes on what people report to give us some inspiration and some confidence and some hope that this could really be something to actually look forward to when the time comes along. So these are subjective experiences. And they're showing really that whatever life you've lived, whether it was virtuous or medium virtuous or even not very virtuous at all, these experiences are available to people. There was even a mafia guy that went into a near-death experience. He was really not a very nice guy. Like really not, you know what mafia... So yeah, violence, drugs, you know, sometimes hostages, all of that kind of thing. And he completely transformed. But the point was, he actually had a near-death experience which was full of bliss and peace. So that's very interesting, isn't it? You know, because we might think, oh, I've done this little thing wrong. Am I going somewhere bad? Probably not, unless you've kind of been in the mafia and, you know, I don't know if you cut anyone's hand off or what, but anyway, I'm sure you've not done anything like that. So the first one that I thought was notable was a boy who drowned. And when we say drowned, of course, we mean that they were pronounced clinically dead at the time, but then they were resuscitated. So they actually did die for a moment. And he said that the mind expands without the limits of the brain and everything felt more real. One moment he was terrified that he was drowning, and the next moment he sort of shifted into this state where he was the one watching the whole thing happening, and he felt an incredible sense of calm. I think that also reminds me of meditation, when we actually get so much mindfulness that we're sort of watching everything just unfold, and there's this sense of really deep calm, and we're more identified at that time with the knower, if you like, than the doing part of the mind. Of course, it's not an ultimate self or a soul, but still there's this sense of equanimity and peace, and whatever's arising in the mind seems not to create too many waves. And the next one was a woman who was one of these professional divers, and she actually, I remember the story, she dived off the board and it was one of those flips, and it sounds so gruesome because she hit the back of her head on the board on the way down. And she went deep down into the water, and, you know, the people around her thought, oh my goodness, they had to dive down to bring her out. And she said it was like she went into a timeless realm where she was loved and things made profound sense. And then there was somebody in a head-on crash who experienced a light that they described as intense love. There was a warm, comfortable, peaceful silence with love surrounding everything and within. And again, they were saying that they felt free from the usual limits of consciousness and thought, so that their mind was free to experience so much more. And it's interesting, in this book, I really recommend reading it from the perspective of understanding a bit more about the mind and the brain and the difference between the two. Because these are doctors, you know, like top of their kind of field. And it seems to be a fairly common, or it's a growing understanding now, that the mind is not at all the product of a brain. I mean, that always sounded ridiculous to me. It's like, how can a lump of stuff create the mind, a lump of physical matter? But it's more that the brain is there to filter the information that the mind knows, filter it down to being concerned only with keeping the five senses alive. In other words, keeping only the body alive, right? So it filters out anything that's not directly related to that, to our survival. That makes sense, right? That makes sense that the brain would be there for that reason. You know, it's this kind of way we're primed, isn't it? If there's a danger, we go to this fight or flight, you know, we have our survival mode. So the brain's all about that. And when that, you know, the five senses or the body disappears, the mind just perceives so much more. And, you know, for someone trained as I was in India and Burma in my meditation, it was normal to talk about things like devas and other realms. It was as normal as saying, I went down to the shop and bought a loaf of bread today. My teacher in Burma would say, today this kind of deva appeared. And there was this incredible smell, and the beauty and the brightness was just sublime, more than anything you could see in the human realm. And, you know, he seemed to live in this world which was far beyond what I could perceive. And yet we can get a sense of that. We can get a sense of the energies in a place, or, you know, a person's aura. Like you can tell, right, if a person's practiced a lot of loving kindness, there's a sense that you're safe with them. And in this kind of way, we can, you know, start to understand there's so much more beyond this physical world, and that death can be an opportunity to explore. It can be an opportunity to really to rest and allow ourselves to experience something beyond this realm of the five senses. And we can start practicing this now. You know, if you don't practice it now, never mind. You get the chance at the time of your death. But we can start practicing now through our meditation and getting a sense of how that could be. You know, that there is something beautiful, there is something profound and sublime. So lastly, before we do a bit more meditation, where we will pretend to die. Does that sound good? Pretend to die? I wanted to just talk a bit about how people who've had these near-death experiences, and I think, you know, people in this room most probably too, anyone who's come in contact with their own mortality or lost a loved one and, you know, maybe accompanied them through that journey, how that can change our attitudes to death. Because this is one of the important things that death contemplation can help with, changing our attitude from something we dread to something we can embrace. And that brings us so much more in line with the reality of the world, the reality of existence. And reality, living in line with reality, is always more fulfilling, more meaningful, more real than living in delusion, living in denial. That's actually more painful in so many ways. So people had lower anxiety after these experiences. They were less likely to avoid the subject of death, and they had a more favorable attitude to life, interestingly. Even though they didn't want to come back straight away, they had a much more favorable attitude to it and also to spirituality. So this mafia guy, if I remember properly, actually transformed his life so much that his girlfriend, who was with him for the kind of, I don't know, the money and the glamour of the thing, she left him. She said, you're just not the same anymore. And he went into some kind of social work kind of role and was a completely transformed person, just simply because he saw something at the end, you know, some other meaning that he maybe couldn't put into words, but that changed his trajectory in life. They also found that they were able to let go of control much more. I mean, this is something, isn't it? How when we're afraid in general, not necessarily of death, but just in general of what's going to happen, we try to control things to the minutest degree. And they were more able to take risks. They were more able to give things a go, you know, and not worry about the outcome so much. The worst thing that can happen is you die, right? Isn't that the worst thing? And if that's not such a bad thing anymore, then of course we can take more risks. I remember when I was in India and, you know, I was 19 when I started my journey, my spiritual path. And after one or two retreats, I knew that this was the life I wanted to live. And I remember once, actually, about 10 years later, meeting a friend and she says, haven't you done something about your pension? Have you got a pension? I said, what? You've got to be kidding. I've been in India. I haven't even had a job. I mean, only a holiday, you know, travel jobs to get me back to the centers so that I could serve. And of course, when I was beginning that journey, I did have some thoughts like, what about in the future if I continue when everybody else is, you know, doing the proper thing in life? And the realization came that through the practice, if I could address that fear, then there wouldn't actually be any concern. So I had this kind of intuition that through the practice, yeah, I would be okay. There was this refuge there. There was a way to work with the fear that would enable me to pursue the path that I was called to pursue. And yeah, it's very wonderful that I could do that at such a young age. And of course, later on in my life, when I was in Perth and Ajahn Brahm asked me to come to England, it was a massive risk because I was leaving the basic container that keeps a monastic alive. It's a support system of lay people who give us food and clothing and medicine, etc. And in return, we teach. And when we leave that, we're basically homeless, without money, without transport. We can't cook for ourselves. And it was, in a way, a crazy, reckless thing to do. But because of this, you know, journey that I'd already been on and taking lots of risks and just going with what I felt to be the calling for myself, fate, you know, always aligning myself with good intentions, making sure I was doing it for the right reasons, it gave me that sense of, yeah, I can give it a go. You know, and it has been really hard work, and I can't say I've not had my fears and doubts. I've had a lot of them, but something about knowing that, you know, it's the meaning of our life and it's our intentions in life that are most important gave me the courage to continue. The other thing is that people find themselves more able to give and receive love. Their hearts are open somehow and they feel more compassion and concern. They're more willing to help other people. So it's interesting. I think it comes back down to, you know, understanding how fragile life is and that basically, you know, all of us, whether we recognize it or not, are going to die. You know, we're going to face our vulnerable moments. We're going to be, you know, lost. We're going to be alone. And when we can picture even the most hardened criminals feeling that way, it softens our mind to them. We're just human beings doing our best, sometimes really on the wrong path, right? Doing terrible things to harm other people. But still, that is also something to feel a lot of compassion for. So what I really liked about reading this book, you know, is that it showed how this gateway to peace is open to any of us, no matter who we are, no matter what race, what gender, what spiritual belief. Many of these people were Christian, but not all of them. If they were Christian, they tended to see God. They interpreted this feeling of love and light as God. But if you're Buddhist, you understand, oh, this is like the nimitta. This is the nimitta that comes in meditation. This is peace. This is the stage where we're moving over to the realm of the mind. And so death becomes something that ultimately is freeing us from our attachments, again, that the Buddha said are the cause of our suffering, and leading us towards a greater, deeper, much more profound and lasting peace.